Welcome to episode 65 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today, I'm talking with Susan Joy Scher, an Alaska-based visual artist, bookbinder, and performer. Her passion for the book form, its structural variations, materials, and potential for movement blends with her interests in sculpture, painting, sewing, and collage. Susan creates an array of wearable books, figures, and architectural forms. Her innovative early performances with fold-out sculpture connected the book with the human body. Enjoy our conversation.
Well, Susan Scher, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you.
Yeah, so you're in Anchorage, Alaska. And
yes.
It looks like our listeners can't see us, but we both have jackets on, and it's early September, where I think it's still hot some places, but it's getting cool here.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to talking to you about your creative life. And let's start with your childhood. Did you have any influences that you think led you to becoming an artist?
My mom was a crafter, a kind of domestic crafter. She was always doing projects that related to the home, making towels that hang on your kitchen handles and other kinds of sewing projects. She taught me how to do embroidery and use a sewing machine when I was a kid. Uh-huh. So I feel like I always had these processes I was learning, these artistic processes, even though they were in a home context.
Right.
I think one of the other influences, I have four brothers and had a very active physical childhood with sports and wrestling. And so the kind of movement and physical contact has always been really important to me too and had filtered into my work.
Yeah. So where do you fall in the range of your brothers?
I have one older brother who's about a year older, and then three younger brothers.
Okay. All right. And so it sounds like you didn't have much art in school.
I did in high school. Uh-huh. And I started doing ceramics in high school and became really interested in the arts at that time.
All right. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Syracuse, New York, and I went to Nottingham High School.
Okay. And they had ceramics at your school?
Yes, they had a great art teacher, Charlie Wolowitz, uh-huh. and he covered all different arts. And I was able to do my last semester, so to speak, in high school, just doing art in his class.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then where did you go to college?
I went to Oswego State University, SUNY at Oswego, for 2 years. And then I was working in ceramics there as well with Richard Zakin. And he thought it would be great if I went to the College of Ceramics at Alfred. So he helped me apply and recommended me to Alfred University. So I went to Alfred for 3 years.
Okay. All right. And so did you get a BFA then?
Yes, I did.
Right.
Yep.
In ceramics.
Sculpture.
Sculpture. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And I'm just curious, at the time, did you have any vision of what your future would hold?
Not really. When I transferred to Alfred, I was expecting that I would continue on with ceramics. But then, of course, in these foundation and school where you're exposed to all different subjects, I was introduced to bookmaking by the professor of printmaking and photography at the time, John C. Wood. Okay. So he showed us how to make books, how to sew pages together, and I just really connected with that process.
So you took a class with him?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so, and that's what you do now. So how did that evolve into, I mean, did you, so was that the end of your studies, or were you making books and ceramics, or like, did you switch to sculptural books?
I worked in all different materials, and okay. One of my focuses at Alfred was welding steel. So I did several large welded steel projects. And it's interesting to look back at them because they have that same repetition that I find really appealing in the book form. I had cut, you know, 50 metal strips and spot welded them together into a particular shape. So it's just that arranging of these panels, repeated panels, to create a shape. And it had an internal structure that supported the shape. So I've always been interested in the three-dimensional qualities of things and the structure, how things are built and supported.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Interesting. So then what did you do after college?
I moved to New York City. In between, I worked at a camp for older adults called Block Vacation Center. Uh-huh. And I ran an art program there for older adults. And it was pretty broad. It had painting and ceramics. And I even made a paper beater out of a lawnmower mounted in a box. And we did hand paper making at Block Vacation Center.
Oh, wow. That's cool. Well, how did you know about paper making?
I can't remember. I think it must have been through Alfred. But also, I worked at Black Vacation Center after I'd moved to New York. Okay. So I was aware of papermaking and people in the book and paper community.
Uh-huh. So moving to New York, you became a book artist.
Yes.
And you worked for the Comprehensive Employment Training Act. Tell me about that.
Yes.
Or you were part of that.
I was part of that. It was a program created under the Carter administration, similar to the Works Progress administration, in that they hired artists around the country, but 500 artists in New York, and artists from every field, dancers and musicians and writers, photographers, theater people. And we were all together in various meetings and collaborating, interacting. So it was really a great beginning of my career to meet people in so many different fields and work with people like Stormy Brandenburger, who was my choreographer for many, many years.
Uh-huh. And so how did you get involved with the program? Did you apply?
I applied for it. Yep. There was an application process.
Uh-huh. And then what kind of work did you do through the program?
Various kinds of assignments, including teaching in classrooms with kids, older adults. I worked for the Brooklyn Arts and Culture Association and renovated a building in downtown Brooklyn called the Downtown Center, I believe. Uh-huh. And it was an old church building that we made into an art center. So there was a gallery and there was a theater upstairs. And I did murals in the bathrooms and curated a number of shows there.
Oh, okay. And did you get a salary for this, or was it sort of pay by the job?
The CETA program paid an annual salary.
Okay.
I think it was $10,000. Right. And you got 1 day a week to work on your own artwork.
Ah, okay. All right. And this was in the 70s.
Yes.
Late 70s.
Late 70s. Yep. 78, 79.
Right. So what kind of work were you doing on your day, and where were you doing that work?
I had a bedroom in a small apartment, and I was just working out of my apartment. Mm-hmm. And making books, folding paper.
Mm-hmm. And were you connected with the Center for Book Arts or other places?
Yes. Part of the way the CETA program was structured, is that they sent you to various nonprofits that related to your field. Oh. So I requested to be involved with the Center for Book Arts. So I was at the Center for Book Arts as a CETA artist.
Okay.
As well as the assignments in the downtown Brooklyn area.
Right. And the Center for Book Arts started in 1976 or four. So this was pretty early on.
It was very early on, Center for Book Arts on Bleecker Street and Bowery.
Right. Yeah, that's before me. Yeah, it was in the next location when I was there. Okay, cool. And yeah, so you were making your own work. Were you exhibiting?
Yes. The connection to the Center for Book Arts created a lot of opportunity. I met so many people, Mindy Dubansky, Richard Minsky, Barbara Mariello, Dick Owen, Esther Faust, and
right.
Carolyn Doug Sturm.
Oh, yeah. 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 And then how did the performance aspect come in? You mentioned the choreographer, and a lot of your work has to do with performance.
I've always been fascinated by the movement of the book. Even early on at Alfred, I was folding a signature and just unfolding it and trying it in different configurations and thinking of the book and the way that we can view it in many different ways as a movement piece. Mm-hmm. So, and I love that, incorporating the body and the book together, and really pursued that for a long time.
Yeah, and I met you in the early to mid 90s, and I think one of the first things I saw was a performance, your performance Unfolding.
Yes.
Tell me about that piece, sort of how, what inspired it and the movement component of it.
In the early 80s there, I was learning so many different structures, ways of folding, gluing, hinging, putting things together. And I was invited as one of three artists in a show called Three American Book Artists in London from the Bookworks Gallery. And so I was traveling to London, and then I was going to bring a piece of artwork, and I thought, okay, what's going to represent all these different things that I've been working on? So I made one piece that had hundreds of different elements in it. And it started out from the center, built out to be a 13-inch cube. And then it was layers of covers and things that folded out, accordion folds, roll folds. And it became this performance. So the 13-inch cube opens out, up and across the floor, and I can build a 5-foot tower with it, and ended up choreographing it and adding music and performing it all over the country and also internationally.
Yeah, that's so cool. Does that happen to be on your website? I mean, I know that's a very old piece.
Yes, I have on my website in the performance section. There's a series of images of that piece and other fold-out pieces that show a bit of the progression of how things work in performance. And I also have some videos up on YouTube and Vimeo that show the movement of some of the pieces.
Okay, awesome. So your website is susanjoyshare.com.
Yes.
And people can hopefully find links to your YouTube channel.
Yes, or just go directly to YouTube, Susan Joy Share. Okay. Same with Vimeo.
Right. Yeah, remember being that in that room, and you just filled the space. It started with just you and that box, this 13-inch cube, and then it unfolded to the left and the right and up and down. And yeah, it's incredible.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. And the sound was also really important to me, the sound of how paper fluttered or how it felt when it banged on the floor, how it felt when you closed a flap on another flap. So I was thinking of it rhythmically as well as physical.
Right. And I just want to mention a few other pieces I remember, like you thinking about, like you had these shoes that you didn't see them until you lifted your foot. And then there was this book under your foot. And then something on your arms that would like become wings or something. So the spaces in the body.
Yes. Yeah. I just actually had a lot of fun too. I feel like my sense of humor comes out in my work. And there's just really funny to walk in these shoes. It's hard to walk in them. You have to lift your knees really high in order to let the accordion hit the ground and be really careful to balance at the same time because it's not the most stable shoe.
Right.
And yeah. But yeah. And they become these animal-like creatures, this kind of imaginary fantasy world. So what is kind of closed and contained and you don't see everything starts to expand and be revealed.
Right. Yeah. And your work is very colorful. So let's talk a little bit about the paper. Because you do different techniques on the paper, different kinds of rubbings and paste papers and to create
yes.
very unique surfaces to covering bookboard a lot of times, I think. And mm-hmm. then you also have really unique ways of attaching and connecting using zippers and snaps. And I mean, I love all of that. And you've inspired my work in that way.
Thanks. I love to paint, and I'm usually very physical when I'm treating a surface, whether it's with paste or rubbings, the action of making those things. In some ways, it's action painting.
Mm-hmm.
And I love color, and I'm not afraid to use various combinations and odd colors like hot pinks and you know, lime greens and things like that from very early on. And mm-hmm. Then I would work on large sheets and then cut and reconfigure them into structural components that became these fold outs and fold up pieces. And the connecting, I think part of it has to do with things that I'm attracted to, metal parts, things that I collect, exploring different ways of hinging.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And to be able to add to a piece and have it work, leaving enough space, just figuring out the technical is really challenging to me.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like that, I took a couple classes with you, one at Penland and I think one at the Center for Book Arts. And so yeah, when like that box unfolding we're talking about, as you had to engineer that, yeah, because each little flap, the hinge had to be a little bigger to fold another flap in, and yeah, that's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and some of that's intuitive, and working on the piece as it goes along, make a section and then measure to that section rather than planning it ahead. It would all kind of evolve as I was working.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, the end point became when it just got too heavy to move or, you know, okay, let me put the final flaps, wrap this thing up.
Right, right, right. And I know you, I want to talk a little bit more about the paper. So I think you amassed a lot of paper in New York that you got rid of some and when you moved to Alaska. Yeah, tell me where you got paper.
Oh, just everywhere. I feel like I was an obsessive paper collector.
Uh-huh.
So there were, in New York is such a treasure of materials.
Yeah.
And there are so many different companies. So my friend Paula Beardell Krieg and I, she had a truck and we would go to various places, including Admiral Envelope, a friend of hers owned, and we would just buy paper. And it was everything you could imagine, from flat sheets of office envelope paper, the yellow kind of ochery paper, tissue paper, translucent papers, cardweight papers, cutoffs. And we would just pile up a pallet full of paper and load it into the truck. They would help us load it. And then Paula and I had studios in the same building. And then we would just, you know, go up the elevator with all this haul of paper. And I've done that in many places, you know, just collecting from printers or ends of lots and things like that. And it came in really handy because I did a lot of teaching artists in schools where I'd have, you know, a whole weeks and weeks of classes with 30 kids in a class, three or four classes a day. So I had this stash of paper that I could cut. I have big paper cutters and prepare materials for classes and also use them in my own work. I also purchased archival materials like map folder stocks and archival corrugated cardboards, book board, and use those as well. And I have a pH pen tester, and I test all the papers to see what quality they are.
Right. And then so your own work versus teaching. So you've taught in the schools, and also you've taught adults at places like Penland and traveling around.
Yes.
I'm just curious about the content of your teaching. Like for children, is it just basic book structures, or did it relate to some of your own inventions?
Oh, yeah, it definitely related to some of my own things. Mm-hmm. I worked with kindergartners in Chinatown in New York City, and we made scrolls that opened out vertical or horizontal. I had them do a belt project once because I collected belt buckles. So I had all these belt buckles, New York City. And we made belts that had several layers so that we were like book belts. And I've always been interested in those things that attach to the body and our relationship physically to the book. So I definitely brought that into my teaching, as well as some basic how to fold or how to make certain kinds of pop-ups or certain types of stitching.
Right. And then your own work, is that always one of a kind? Have you ever done an edition?
I've done a few small editions, and usually with a lot of handwork in them, but more I make one of a kind pieces.
Right. And tell me about your relationship to book dealers, artist book dealers, and selling your books.
I've been represented by some of the main book art sellers like Vamp and Tramp Booksellers. Tony Zwicker was an artist book dealer back in the day, and have pieces in various collections around the country.
Right. Cool. Yeah. Okay, so you lived and worked in New York City until the late 90s?
Yes, I 97, 98, moved up to Alaska.
And what brought you there?
Well, I had taught a class at Haystack Mountain School, and I met Paul Stang there, and we started a relationship, and for 5 years, we had a commuting relationship between Washington, D.C. and Brooklyn. And then he wanted to move to Alaska for some of his work. So we made some agreements and negotiated particulars. And then I ended up moving up to Alaska.
Right. And so you've been there 20 plus years now. So you're
20
really
plus years
integrated into the community. And you're in Anchorage?
Yes.
Right. And did you, how did your work change? It must have shifted.
It did. I think I felt like I could redefine myself a little bit. And just being exposed to more subtle colors, like the winters here are very white and gray and have an incredible beauty, just this kind of softness and subtlety of color. So I came to appreciate more of that in my work, where I was like bright colors. I think part of the working on these collapsible structures in New York was because it was easy for me to store things because I didn't have a lot of space. And here there's just more space. And so I feel like some of my things are less collapsible, or I've been working more, you know, on some just flat wall work or.
Right. I was thinking about that with the unfolding piece because you took it to England. That must have been part of It had to it fit was, in a suitcase or something.
And it was so compact, and I could bring just a massive piece of work in a very small package.
Yeah, right.
Which is really a great advantage for, you know, storing your work. And I still keep those pieces, all the performance pieces, which are many, including hats and belts and paper costumes. I made these paper paneled costumes, headdresses, and I have those in my collection in my library, and I'm glad that they are compact.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to tell you about the Paper Year, which is going online in 2021. This is an annual subscription club, kind of like a year-long online class, featuring a new paper project each and every month. Get inspired with video and written project instructions designed to spark ideas that keep you creating for the rest of the month. Explore creative paper techniques, including origami, pop-ups, paper weaving, book arts, paper cutting, and more. And join our growing community of paper lovers online to learn and share in a warm, encouraging, supportive, creative environment. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com to find out more and hold your spot. Registration opens in late December, and the first project will be delivered on January 4th.
I wanted to talk about something I read about on your website, book gatherings.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
In the early 80s, I got my 501c3 nonprofit status and created this organization called Book Gatherings, and curated a number of shows between 1980 and 1986 of books by artists and related performances. And some of those were in Brooklyn at the organization I mentioned before, the Baca Downtown Center. And others were at, I think we curated three at the library at the Metropolitan Museum with Mindy Dubansky. And yeah. So.
Cool. And then did that just fizzle out or?
Oh, you know, in those days, running a small nonprofit like that pretty much single-handedly was a lot of work. I did mass bulk mailings, and I'd be carrying, like, you know, 500 pieces of mail to the post office. And I think it just 7 years of working on that really took a lot of my energy. So.
Right. Yeah. Understandable. And it's cool how, things can ebb and flow. I think that's common for artists.
Yeah.
So another thing, in Alaska, you've started doing public art commissions.
Yes.
So tell me how you got into that.
Well, Alaska has a pretty vibrant art community, including a municipal 1% for art in Anchorage and a statewide 1%. And when a school is built or highways, any kinds of public projects, there's a 1% for art.
So 1% of the budget is allocated to art. And that's so interesting, because that's how I got to New York City. I was an intern for the Percent for Art program in 1987. And it was a pretty young program at that point. Yeah.
And how was that connected to 1%?
City building, any city building in New York, 1% of the budget went to an art project. So the Percent for Art program was a slide registry, and they put together panels that chose the artists for different sites. There were maybe any 20 projects at a time going on.
And what was your, what did you do as part of the 1%?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Oh, I was an intern. Organized slides. And I got to go to a few meetings. It was a small, there were just two people running it. So I got to see everything, but I was only there. It was a 4-month internship, very short.
That's great.
Yeah.
And it sounds unusual to me to have it be an internship, because my experience is that most of the 1% are to make some type of artwork, an installation of some kind.
Yeah, well, this was an unusual situation. I wanted to move to New York, and I was in college my senior year trying to figure out how to get to New York. And we had a new professor from New York, and there was a he knew the people at Percent for Art. And then there was a grant that my college would pay if I found an internship in the public sector. So that those two things collided. So it wasn't like they had an internship program. Uh-huh. I just called them and said, hey, could I come work for you for free because I have funding for my college?
Sounds like a good deal.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyways, so how did you get involved with the Percent? So
well,
you heard about it.
Yes, there was a new school being built, a high school. Mm-hmm. And apparently a couple from Boston got that Percent for Art project. And they wanted to work with local artists to complete some of the artwork in this new high school. And mm-hmm. I was chosen by them to participate in that particular project.
Oh, so you didn't have to apply for that one.
They secured
it and you
yes,
got hired.
They That's secured cool. it and I was mm-hmm. hired. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So as part of that, I think I was hired because I had made a series of Coptic bindings with clay covers. Mm. And they were interested in tile pieces. The building was still being built and they wanted to incorporate the artwork into the structure of the building. So because they saw some of these elaborate covers that I had made, flat tile-like covers, I was able to design some tile murals that were inset into various parts of the building, including boys and girls restrooms and some hallway stairwells and things like that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. It was great. I rented a studio from a ceramic artist friend and worked there for a long time making tiles, designing large pieces and then cutting them up into tile, you know, what would be a reasonable tile shape, and then going through the clay process of drying, bisquing, waxing, glazing, and then reassembling.
Right. And so tell me a little bit about your studio. Did you do all this in your studio?
I rented a studio from a ceramic friend. I didn't have a clay studio.
Right.
Okay. I have a studio that is more book and paper with paper cutters and flat files and tools and collections.
Right. And where is that? Do you commute to it or is it close?
Yes, it's pretty close. It's a couple miles from where I live in a commercial strip mall, like a storefront.
Uh-huh. And are you the only artist? Are there other artists in there?
I share my studio with another artist who's a great studio mate. So I'm lucky to have someone that I can get along with who doesn't use toxic materials and all that. The rest of the business is in the strip mall or like a hair salon and a bar school and non-artists.
Right. And what are you working on in the studio right now?
I've been putting together pieces for an exhibit that's going to be in Homer, Alaska, Bunnell Gallery in the fall. And the title of the show is Fragile Domestic. So a lot of the work relates to sewing and some of those things I mentioned earlier on that I learned as a child, embroidery. Also coming into it is the whole like isolation and things that have been happening since the COVID virus took hold.
Right.
So.
Yeah. How has that affected your work? Has it much? Or, I mean, did you have teaching things happening that have changed? Or
I started teaching on Zoom. So so that's a big change, getting used to and learning how to do that. But challenging and fun also. Mm-hmm. I started using things that I had at home because I wasn't going to the studio, even though I'm the only one in my studio or I had a studio mate. I felt like I just needed to be home. We were in what we called hunker down, so staying home. Mm-hmm. So I used some of the materials I had here at home and started creating artwork with them. Mm-hmm. So
are you still doing that? It's September now. So
no,
I'm going to the studio.
Things are more open. I've been going to the studio. I'm also working on packets for a class I'm teaching that starts in the fall of 2020. And it's a kind of also a labor of love of putting packet materials together for like 20 plus students. But I'm enjoying that too, making just different, you know, wounds of thread and a little tool package for everybody and pre-cut materials.
So how does that differ compared to if you were to go into the classroom? You might not cut the thread and package it, but
right.
Some of it you would prepare ahead of time.
Some of it I would prepare because classes are usually in the setting I'm in here are an hour and a half with a lot of other activities going on. So you might have an hour or less of teaching time. Mm-hmm. But definitely people working more independently, less planned out. And but I think that people's direction and path in their thinking and artwork and creativity can be brought out even if you have a set number of materials and a set size, because in a way it's just a sample of what can be done.
Right. Yeah. No, I totally believe that. Yeah. So you're learning something that you can take to the next level.
Yep.
So is this adults or children, this particular class?
It's older adults, and it's in collaboration with the staff at the Anchorage Museum. I've worked at the Brooklyn Museum too, at the Anchorage Museum, and they're fantastic. And incorporating writing and organizing the whole process and the Zoom meetings and making sure they go well and registering people and communicating. So it's really great to collaborate with the Anchorage Museum.
Yeah, and so do they handle the mailing of the packets?
Yeah, some people will come pick them up,
okay.
And then they'll handle the mailing.
Oh, interesting. That's cool. Yeah, it's been a big transition to online. I'm thankful I was already teaching online before COVID hit, but I had some in-person events that I had to cancel, so I planned more online. And I haven't done so much in person online. That's what you're doing, right? You'll meet via Zoom and
yes.
teach the class. Yeah.
Yes.
Mine are pre-recorded more. So. But I've done little bit of the in person.
Yeah. Yes, it's going to be in person, and I'm learning more about how to connect well with students on Zoom. It's a different thing,
yeah.
And you know, being aware of the screen and being able to listen and watch where there's a question and also be teaching. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Okay. You just in our correspondence leading up to this podcast, you said that you like to swim and I'm a swimmer. So I wanted to talk about that. And I've been swimming since June because I swim in an outdoor pool and they opened up, and I was wondering what it would be like, but it's so far so good. We have to sign up and go at certain times. And first it was just one person in a lane. Now it's two, but it sounds like you haven't been.
Yeah. I would love to, but the pool I swim in is still closed.
Mm-hmm.
There are some more open pools in town, and I know people who've been swimming, but I'm kind of not ready to go there yet for indoor swimming. But I, you know, it seems to be working out for some of the people that I know. So.
And you've swum for a long time?
Oh, I grew up swimming
from
upstate New York, and there's just so many freshwater lakes there. And I've always loved distance swimming. So you swim across the lake or around the lake and really had a lot of fun. And then I never did lap swimming until I was in Brooklyn and at the YWCA in Brooklyn. And
okay, so where was that?
Third Avenue and Atlantic Avenue.
Okay.
Third and Atlantic.
Yeah,
I think Third Street, maybe. Yeah.
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 Cool. Well, I'm happy we share that.
Yeah. Well, it's such a wonderful place to be in the pool, immersed and rhythmic. I love the breathing and the arms and legs. I always do kicks and do. I have a 3 or 4 different workouts I do and kind of switch off.
Cool. And yeah, I think I can think quite a bit while I'm swimming. Mm-hmm. This is the first time since we moved to Colorado, I joined a master's group. We don't compete or anything, although some of the people I swim with are competitive athletes, triathletes, mm-hmm. most of them. But it's fun to have the workout, because prior to that, for, I don't know, 20 years or something, I was just swimming a mile or 2 miles, and that's pretty repetitive.
But it's pretty great. That's a long distance.
Yeah. Okay, and I wanted to get to your recommendations. Listeners, this is something new. I'm going to start asking my guests to recommend some things. So Susan has some things she wants to recommend. So let's talk about your favorite, one of your favorite tools, the Spring Divider.
Yeah, I love the Spring Divider. For those who aren't familiar with it, it's like a compass, except you can set the distance of the tongs apart. There's many different kinds. Some of them are kind of flat and squared edges, but I have one that is about 4 inches, and it has a rounded feet, and also a little teeny point at the end, like an awl point, on both sides. And I use that to measure and punch at the same time. And it's just a really great tool for sewing, if I'm doing any kind of sewing along an edge or embroidery. And I have something under it, like some piece of corrugated board or something to punch into.
So you just kind of walk it along back and forth and punch?
I punch straight down. You get 2 holes at a time.
Okay.
So I punch straight down, I lift it up, and then I put one side in the previous hole one in the next.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Cool. And where do you get Spring Dividers?
I looked it up, and I saw that Talus does have a rounded one, mm-hmm. Like a 4-inch one. So you can get it there. It wasn't exactly what mine was, but mm-hmm. it was close enough. I think with the Spring Divider, you have to be careful to not go too deep, because sometimes they broaden very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So
the point can
broaden very quickly. So you just have to learn the right pressure.
Right. And I want to just mention Talus is a bookbinding supplier in New York. And when I lived there, it was in New York City. Now it's in Brooklyn. And at the New York City location, they had a great case of old tools. And I actually purchased, I remember this one day, 2 Spring Dividers, probably after I took a class with you. One tiny one. It's only about 3 inches tall. And then a maybe 12 inch. And I have to say, I don't use them.
Uh-huh. That's funny.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Well, yeah, they're really specific for certain things, or, you know, if you want to find the center of something.
Right.
It's easy way to do it without measuring.
Right. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And you also had a book to recommend, Braiding Sweetgrass.
Yes. I loved this as an audiobook read by the author, Robin Wall Kimmerer, and she's a botanist and plant ecology professor. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful book to listen to while I was doing my repetitive processes. Beautifully written, and it's about indigenous wisdom, ecological consciousness, and lots of stories about plants and the environment, reciprocity, and healing the earth. I felt like it affirmed a lot of things for me. I have been in our area trying to get rid of invasive plants, and so spend time pulling invasives or just kind of watching that they don't come back. And she talks about that in the book, about how removing invasives is a way of healing the earth. And I felt like, wow, those hours I spent getting rid of these weeds, you know, it's okay.
It was worth it. Yeah. And you said she talked about the area you grew up in?
Yes. Apparently she is or was a professor at Syracuse University. Oh. And so she is also Potawatomi, which is a native group from that area, and talks about Onondaga County, which is where I grew up, and Onondaga Lake specifically, which was such a central part of Native culture and then became the most polluted lake in the country with various industries that were on the lake. So there's a chapter about Onondaga Lake, which is just a very moving chapter, depressing in a lot of ways, but also hopeful.
Yeah, nice. And how do you listen to your books on tape? Do you use Audible or the library?
I have Libby, a library.
Okay. Yeah. I love, we have something called Overdrive. I love listening to books on tape and podcasts when I'm in my studio.
Yeah. I find that if I'm doing something repetitive, I can listen, but if I'm focusing on more creative work, I lose it. But then you can always go back and listen again and pick up where you drifted out.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. I don't even turn anything on. I usually listen when I'm making paper because that's very repetitive. And my mind even then starts to wander from listening to a book on tape. But yeah, when I'm planning something or whatnot, I can't listen. Cool. And then you mentioned Paula Beardell Krieg before, and I'm actually going to have Paula on the podcast in a couple of months.
Oh, fantastic. Great.
So she's another recommendation. She has a fantastic blog.
It's incredible. She's got so many projects and instructions and a documentation of her work with kids and her explorations into mathematics.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend Paula Beardell Krieg Book Zumpa.
Is it bookzumpa.com, do you think?
I believe it is, bookzumpa.com, Playful Bookbinding and Paperworks.
Right, great. And then finally, Growing Garlic.
Oh, well, I have a brother, Ira, in Kathy, his wife, in upstate New York, and they've been farmers kind of on the land for a long time, and one of their main crops is garlic. And so he sends me garlic seed every year, and I've been planting garlic here in Alaska and just really enjoying that I'm connected to my family in that way, mm-hmm. kind of a garlic family. Mm-hmm. And the plant is such a great plant. You can eat the scapes. It's beautiful, like a tall grass. And then in the fall, you have this wonderful garlic fist, and I've been able to share with people in my community. I give seed away and give garlic away, so I feel like it's a really nice way of connecting with people.
Yeah, and is it fairly easy to grow? Is that another element?
Yeah, I haven't had to really do too much other than water it occasionally, and just nice. the moose don't eat it.
Ah, okay. So the moose come right into town.
The moose come all the time to our yard. This year mm-hmm. we've had a regular black bear visiting as well. So
yeah.
So the crops that I'm growing on the downstairs of our property pretty much have to be moose proof.
Got it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. And I just wanted to mention that, well, I'm so excited to have you on this podcast, but coming up in the future, Susan is going to, she's contributed quite a section to my new book, which will be out hopefully in the fall of 2021. And I asked her to sort of put together some samples of her, all these cool fasteners, from magnets to snaps to buttons and sewing. And so there's going to be a section in the back of the book that covers all of this, and then a project in the book as well. So I'm super excited about that. And then she's also going to be a guest artist. Some of you know I produced the 12 months of paper calendar, which this year is the paper year. It's a project every month. And this past year I had several guest artists. And then in 2021, I'm taking this online. So there'll be a monthly project online, more like a class, but a simple project that you can do anytime during the month. And Susan will be featured next year.
Oh, I'm excited. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's I'm honored to be part of your book and really had fun developing the different projects and making samples. So thank you for including me in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited. And so let's just wrap up with, so this episode, I forgot to look up the exact date, but it'll come out in November or December, and you're going to be part of a group show in Anchorage that happens late fall.
Yes, and that is called Extra Tough Women of the North.
Mm.
And it's about the roles, the vital roles that both Indigenous and newcomers women to Alaska have made in the northern communities.
Oh,
so, cool. And I'll be exhibiting pieces related to landscape, but there's also pieces about gender roles, social norms, and women's work and child rearing.
Nice. And these will be book works.
Mine are flat paper pieces, like dimensional crumpled paper pieces.
Oh.
That relate to topographics and aerial views of Denali Park.
Ah, okay. Okay, and hopefully we'll be able to see images online.
Yes, in a bit.
Yeah. Well, when the podcast comes out, might time up right.
Ah, yeah.
Okay. Well, Susan, it's been a treat. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Helen.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.